Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Yeah, friends, hey, here at NOLA Drinks, we think if you're saying you're going to put your family and your country first, you're probably not going to take a bullet for the guy anymore, are you? Glad to see you finally have your priorities straight. Hey, friends, we got a good show coming up for you here today. We chat with Kirk Stopenall, and Kirk is one of the co-proprietors, along with Neil Bodenheimer, friend of the show, and Matt Conkey as well, who own and operate both Cure and Cane and Table, two fine establishments here in New Orleans. And it's a great conversation that we have with Kirk, of note, of among many things that we talk about. Cure was the most recent recipient of Outstanding Bar Program in the James Beard Awards this year. That's two in a row in New Orleans, by the way. Just saying, about the sixth year of the award. Last year, our good friend Chris Hanna over there, French 75 Bar, Arno's, got it going on. Little win streak here for New Orleans, and rightfully so. So we chat with Kirk at their establishment, Cane and Table. Also a great place. They're located on the 1100 block or so of Decatur. And we talk about what they got going on there. We talk about Cure. We talk about the James Beard Award. We talk about Kirk's interesting career and career path. He's a native of the area where he finds himself these days. And I'll get to that in a second, a little bit more about some other things that we chat about related to kind of a theme going on here, friends with the show. But a very interesting conversation with Kirk. We talk about Cure, some of the emphasis about how it's a classic cocktail bar in a lot of ways, the emphasis on making classic cocktails, maybe with slight variations, executing things very, very well. Cane and Table, as they sort of like to say, out of convenience. We have a good laugh about this. It's a proto tiki bar. Go back and listen to the show the week before last with our good friend Jeff Beach Bumberry there at Latitude 29, the famous tiki author, historian, as well as a restaurateur, as I just said, Latitude 29. So we talk about tiki, which is sort of a faux culture, and then we talk about proto-tiki, which is sort of a made-up term of a faux culture. Okay, I don't know if you follow that or not. I'm not sure that I follow, but it's all very, very interesting. But really what Cane and Table does is they get back to kind of going pre-prohibition drinks and even going back to colonial America and some of that stuff. So a lot of they always have a punch there, for example. But it's a very interesting conversation to speak with Kirk about what he thinks about cocktails, what they do at their two operations. And then, let me get to this in just a second, because there's a theme that we've got running the last week's show, this week's show, and what will be on next week's show. So that's where I'm going with this, is a good friend, Fred Perrant, who is one of the brand ambassadors for Hendrix Gin, is going to be returning to join us. Fred was on with us on November 16th of last year, of course, 2017. If you want to catch that show, it's a very interesting and fun conversation with Fred. Just go to noladrinks.com. If you Google Hendrix Gin or Fred Perrant, or Fred Parent, if you will, Fred's got roots in the area, and Fred, great interview. So go catch that. He's going to be on coming up. And Fred, not only is he one of the brand ambassadors for Hendrix Gin, but he's also got a strong music background. So Fred's going to join me for a little bit. And then two of his friends with whom he's doing a very interesting collaborative project, that talks about music and sort of maybe bringing some things together. If you're in the service industry, or some folks that are in, you know, talking about those in the service industry, a lot of people that you may know when you're out at a bar, when you're out at a restaurant that's serving your table, maybe making your food, working behind the stick as a bartender. Very often, a lot of these folks, especially here in New Orleans, do other things. A lot of my friends that are in the service industry here in town, they're musicians, they're artists, they're craftspeople. They do all kinds of other interesting things. And what Fred is kind of doing in part with this project and other things that he does is sort of communicating about bringing those two worlds together, and they don't have to be mutual exclusives. And I think that that's a very interesting concept. And what he's going to be doing with his two friends, melding music and some of these things, it's kind of an exclusive, as Fred told me today on the phone, if you're listening here on the radio. So I'm looking forward to the interview, because we're going to talk about exactly what he and his two buddies are up to, and I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. But that gets me back to this sort of thematic thing. We go back to the show last week when we interviewed Caroline Rosen, who is the new executive director of Tales of the Cocktail. Hope you caught that show. If not, you can easily get on your favorite podcast platform, or you can get it on our website, as I said, noladrinks.com. But one of the things that Tales of the Cocktail is doing as a trade show for bartenders and the spirits industry is addressing issues in that industry. We talked a lot about how they're doing a much better job with that than the previous Tales of the Cocktail Regime. Go catch those shows if you want to hear more about that. But one of the issues in the industry is work-life balance. It has always been the case that work-life balance, when you're in the service industry, can be a very difficult thing to reach, a very difficult thing to strike that balance. You're often working when everyone else is not working. That's how you make money, right? You're working Friday nights, you're working Saturday nights, you work until 2 a.m. And oftentimes, you got cash in your pocket, you got some tips. You might go out with your working friends and go to that industry bar at 3 a.m. Hey, we don't shut down, as we know, if you're listening here in New Orleans, we don't shut down at 2 a.m. or whatever the time may be that you stop serving. So there's certainly a bar around the corner from where you work that's open, serving drinks at 3 o'clock. You do that. You're up odd hours compared to a lot of other people, and so, you know, finding time to work out, finding time to exercise, finding time to read, finding time to pursue your hobby that doesn't have anything to do with work can be a really tricky thing to navigate. Now you also throw in the fact that in this instance, we have alcohol around, right? And so, you know, there's drinking on the job. And it's a very interesting question that's going on. And I don't have a judgment on this. I used to run tasting rooms in the wine industry in California for quite a while. And at that time, when I was doing that, especially mom and pop wineries where I worked, it was still legal for you to have volunteers work a Saturday afternoon for you in the tasting room, and they were compensated in wine. You got to take 2 or 3 bottles home, and then, you know, you got to sip on wine while you were there. Whenever I worked in the tasting room, not whenever, but often when I worked in the tasting room, especially on weekends, I would sip on some wine. I found it fun. It was one of the perks of the job. I think people find that sometimes, you know, it helps with the hospitality building, but it is not necessary with the hospitality building. You don't have to drink on the job. Yes, it's fun to go out, see your buddies, and they're behind the bar and you do shots with them and stuff like that. I'm not saying that that's not okay, but what I am saying is that you don't have to do that. So Tales of the Cocktail is addressing this in certain ways with even some of their programming coming up at the event. Kirk, coming up here on the show with Cane and Table and Cure, he no longer drinks on the job. He doesn't tell his employees that they cannot, but he doesn't expect them to. And sometimes there's that expectation. And I mentioned that Fred, this is a big thing. Fred Perron from Hendrick's Gin will be on next week, as I just said. It's also a big thing for him. And I think that we're starting to see people address that. Now, as I said, I'm not coming down on one side or the other. When I used to work tasting rooms, one of the things that I always used to tell people, they would ask, well, how much can I drink? That's really kind of an individual question. My only requirement was I expect you to be professional, maintain that level of professionalism, and do your job throughout your shift. The purpose of why you're there is to provide hospitality, showcase the wine, and sell the wine. As long as you're doing that effectively, as long as you're remaining safe, doing your job, providing that experience, and you're also capable of getting yourself home in a safe and legal fashion, then that's really up to you, and everybody's different. Now, some companies, bars and restaurants, for example, and a lot of chain stuff, of course, have done this forever. They do not allow you to drink on the job, and that's to basically ensure a level of professionalism, hospitality, safety, so on and so forth. That's fine. You get where you come from there. Some of the smaller places, they take a different stance, and I think that's okay too. Look, if I owned a small bar or restaurant, craft cocktail place, I'd allow people to, this is just my own personal choice, I would allow people to drink on the job. But again, my requirement is going to be, as I just described, maintaining a level of professionalism while you're on the job and making sure that you don't go overboard. And the other part of this is making sure that this doesn't creep over into other aspects of your life such that you are not healthy, that you are not leading a healthy overall lifestyle. Because of course, if you're not, then that's going to affect your ability to do your job in the long run, of course, and that's not good for you as an individual. So I'm glad that the industry is asking these questions. I'm glad that they're addressing these questions. I'm glad that people that are leaders in the industry are addressing these issues and creating a situation and a workspace and an environment overall in the industry where it's okay not to drink. It's okay not to drink completely. It's okay not to drink on the job. It's okay not to drink when you don't want to drink. It is not a requirement. Sure, it can happen. Sure, it's fine when it does, as long as it's in a measured way, as I'm just describing, but it's not required. And so you, friends, if you're listening and you're a patron, you're an enthusiast, you go out to these places, yeah, it's great to go do shots with your buddy who's the bartender that's been serving you for years. Don't expect them to. And I know most of us probably don't even think about it, so that's fine. Don't expect them to. If they choose to and they want to with you, that's great. But if they pour you and the person you're with or whatever a shot, toast them and don't necessarily expect them to do it with you. And that's okay too. We want everybody to have a healthy well-measured, well-balanced work life and personal life. I think it's an important thing. So kind of a little theme running here on last week's show, this week's show, and next week's show. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to be right back with Kirk Estopinall of Cure and Canaan Table. Come on back.
Girl, it may be true, honey, I may be the fool. I'm here smiling and winking and making lies at you. Well, I could be wrong, you could have been made.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning into the show today. Really appreciate it. And we are here at one of my favorite places in New Orleans, Cane and Table, a very, very fine restaurant. And I'm pleased to be joined by Kirk Estopinall. Kirk, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Welcome. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's great to have you on. We've had you, one of your partners in crime, Neil Bodenheimer, has been on 2-3 times. It's the first time you've been on, so I'm happy to talk to you, man.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah. So really cool, man. Cane and Table is a great spot where we have y'all. And you guys also operate Cure Uptown on Ferret Street, where happen to be sitting last night when we were taping. So time warp thing, I'm not going to do that math for people. But tell us a little bit, Kirk, about how did you get involved in the restaurant and bar business, man?
Yeah, well, I basically have always worked in the restaurant and bar business. When I was younger, in high school, I wanted a new skateboard, and my parents were like, "Well, get a job." So my aunt got me a job at a steakhouse in Algiers here in New Orleans, called Aurora Steakhouse. And I worked there as a busboy, and I was terrible, and I didn't know what I was doing. But from there, I kind of went on and worked for a company here called Simolina. And I worked for them for almost 12 years. And I worked through the ladder there. I was a catering salesperson, a bar manager, a service manager, a waiter, everything you could do there, basically. And then I really didn't like my job very much, to be quite honest. It kind of like ground me up a little bit. That happens a lot, I think, between like kind of going from being on the floor to management in restaurants. It's a big adjustment.
Yeah.
And I did not really know what I was getting into there. And then Hurricane Katrina came. And it was really all up in the air. So from that moment, that I had talked to the guy who was in charge of me there, and I was like, I don't know what's gonna happen. He's like, we're kind of reconfiguring some things right now, and we'll reach out to you. And I was like, you know what? I think I'm gonna leave. So I actually decided at that moment to move on. And my wife, who she worked for Saks Fifth Avenue here and caught fire.
Oh, yeah.
And they were going to be closed for about a year, they were expected. So they offered transfers. And the two options we had were New York or Chicago. And I had a really good friend, my best friend in the world growing up, was living there at the time. So
in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah. So I called him and was like, hey, I'm thinking about moving to Chicago. And he's like, yeah, just come and stay with me. And you can see how it is, right? And then I was like, okay, sure. So we went up there for a few days just to check it out. This is like really right after the storm. And I was like, I like it here. And my wife checked out Saks, and then we decided to stay. So a guy named Terry Alexander is a restaurateur there, has a group called One Off Hospitality. And they are they have a lot of great places, the Violet Hour being one of them.
Sure.
As well as Publican, Blackbird, Avec. I mean, they're like a super group of great restaurants in Chicago. But he basically was like, any of your friends from New Orleans, Charlie, I'll hire them immediately. So I got a job.
Was this, Kirk, was this because there was a trust in the sense of understanding hospitality?
I think it was about my friend, you know, more than anything.
Okay,
and
so
like
that
kind of the New Orleans vibe that Charlie always had with him.
Okay.
So we met, and yeah, I think it was a lot of like, you know, there were a lot of people out there trying to help people from New Orleans at the time. And I think it was important to Terry to do that. He's a very gracious person. So I got a job running food at a restaurant for them. My wife was a coat check person for them for a little while too. Alfredo, who's our chef here at Canaan Table, got a job waiting tables at another of their restaurants. And his girlfriend at the time, her name's Christy Plyer. She's an accountant here in New Orleans now. Took a job with them as well. And they really just kind of rolled it out for us and helped us kind of get on our feet. I worked there as a food runner just for a short while. They really didn't have a position for me. They were just opening a place they had just hired. And just really quickly after that, I moved to behind the bar there because I had experience. I worked with this great guy, Brad Bolt, who opened Bar DeVille in Chicago.
Sure, yeah.
We actually opened the Violet Hour together. But that restaurant closed because of some weird management problems. One of the partners was a thief. So they were like, we're shuttering this restaurant. And it was like 9 months old. And I was like, oh, wow. No, what am I going to do? My friend Charlie was working for Sean McClain, who's a chef in Chicago, had a restaurant called Spring there. They had just won the Beard. I was like, you know, maybe I could work there. And Charlie got me the job there. So I worked there while they reconfigured the restaurant we were at called Del Toro into the Violet Hour.
Okay.
Terry was like, I need you to go to New York, and I need you to meet this guy, and I need you to go to these bars, and then you can work here.
Just to do some recon?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Honestly, like, I had, like, had some cocktails and had made cocktails. I've been a bartender for years, but, like, I hadn't really seen the deep depths of it and how like special it could be and how detail oriented it could be.
So were you just kind of priori slinging rum and cokes?
Yeah,
kind
I mean,
of thing?
We made some cocktails, you know, okay. But it wasn't like high thought-minded stuff there. It was just like, you know, like, I got this product and we need to sell it, so you make a special, that
right.
kind of thing, you know?
Right,
I mean,
gotcha.
I think that's most of us came up that way. I mean, at that time, it was like all, like, there was like the teeny craze, so it was like, you know, it was like apple pucker and vodka shake and strain and sugar-rimmed right, everything, right. You know, everything was like a duo, a two-part drink. I went off to New York and met Toby Maloney, who's like kind of, I mean, you know, he taught me everything I know, honestly. He's like a mentor to me in a big way. He worked at Milk and Honey for years.
Okay.
And he's actually kind of the creative element behind the Violet Hour. So Terry, he ironically had worked for Terry as an oyster shucker years ago at a restaurant in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Terry like ran into him at a bar and they worked out a deal. And that's really how the Violet Hour came to be. So I went on this tour, and Toby took me out to all these great places. I went to Milk and Honey. I went to Death and Company. I went to Angel Share. I went to Freeman's. I went, you know, all the places that are now like the legend places.
That we associate with the touchstone as the craft cocktail renaissance
exactly,
touchstone.
Yeah. And on that trip, I met like Janet and Avery from Bitterman's.
Okay.
I met Jim Meehan, who's become a dear friend of mine. Joaquin Simo is a big dear friend of mine now. It's kind of really like set my whole stage there. That trip was really important in my life. And then we opened the Violet Hour, went through the training, and then we were kind of left on our own. It was interesting because Toby like gave us all the drinks and kind of the education, but then he didn't live there. So it was like a ragtag group of mostly kitchen guys.
Figuring it out as you go?
Yeah, like we just kind of figured it out as we went, you know. And, you know, I worked there for about a year and a half. And then I decided to move back home to New Orleans. I figured the best time to move back would be Tails. If I was going to meet anybody that did anything like
sure.
I was doing then, you know. I went to a spirited dinner that the Death and Company boys were doing at Stella.
Okay.
Rob Cooper, who's since passed on, you know, in Saint Germain.
Mm-hmm.
He introduced me and Neil.
Okay. So you did not know Neil growing up here?
No,
before.
No, not at okay. all. Me and Neil never met until 2007 or early 2008.
Gotcha.
And we met and had a quick conversation, and I was like, I'll be back in like 2 weeks to live here for good. And then we had a meeting at our friend Miles, who actually now runs Bacchanal, mm-hmm. He was the chef at the country club at the time.
Okay.
And we were like, well, I know Miles, and he knew Miles because he worked with him at Delachaise. So we're like, well, let's go check out Miles' place. And we had our first meeting there, and like handshook a deal on Cure right there on the spot. And, you know, the rest is, you know, all the hard work we've done since
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Kirk, let's do this because that kind of tees up the story really well. We're going to take a little break here, sure. And then we're going to come back, and we'll talk a little bit about Cure, which, you know, congratulations, you guys got the outstanding bar program.
Thank you.
For James Beard Award, which is fantastic. We'll talk a little bit about that, and of course, we'll talk about Canaan Table, and then we'll always encourage listeners, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast, because Kirk and I are going to stick around for another shot with Noel Drinks, and we're going to get a little bit more into the weeds, as we say. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drinks Show. Come on back.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I see a little.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. We are here at Cane and Table in the French Quarter, Decatur Street. We are chatting with one of the co-proprietors, Kirk Estopinal. Kirk, and thanks, buddy, for having us here, man. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Yeah, so we got a little bit of your background. So you moved back here. You and Neil Bodenheimer got together. And just so people know what we're talking about, you know, so one of your partners in Cure, and you guys opened up, which what I think is really kind of the original craft cocktail bar, as far as the new wave of craft cocktail bars go in New Orleans.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Is that a fair assessment? Sure. Yeah. Yeah. On Ferret Street. And I'm kind of gathering that, and we've chatted with Neil on the show before. So some of this is, I guess, you know, where your experience in Chicago, your experience doing the recon, as we said, in New York, kind of opened your eyes to this stuff. And
absolutely.
Did you see that, like, hey, we need this in New Orleans?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, when I moved back, I'm not sure that was my full plan. I mean, I definitely was like, I want to open a bar akin to this idea. So I took a look at a couple bars, like, as soon as I got home. But yeah, then meeting Neil, it was kind of like already on its way. We have another partner, Matt.
Yep.
Him and Matt had already had, like, the plans. They had already, they purchased the building. So it was more like kind of, it just like was a lot easier route to go for me at that moment.
Sure.
You know?
Okay.
So yeah, we went ahead and pulled on it, but yeah, it was, I don't know if we knew what we were doing or, you know, we were trying hard.
Let me ask you this question, because I think, you know, when we go back, this is what, 2010 y'all opened? Is that about right?
Yeah. It'll be 10 years this year.
Okay. So 2008.
Yeah, February this year will be our 10-year anniversary at Cure.
Yeah. So that, I mean, where y'all are uptown on Ferret Street, that had to be a bit of a challenging neighborhood at that time, right? To open up that type of place.
I mean, it was in a challenging neighborhood as far as permitting. It was there was an overlay at the time that Stacy Head had put down there, and it made it a lot easier to
I sort of mean demographically.
But demographically, sure. It was an unknown. Mm-hmm. Ferret Street was at one time like a shopping corridor. There was a wonderful bakery there. There was like a couple old restaurants that had been there for years. But a lot of that just kind of peeled away over the years. Mm-hmm. And then when the hurricane came, that area took water. I mean, there's a lot of things happened there. So it was definitely, it was a moment that Matt, our partner, really felt like it was a moment that like there was going to be a sea change there. And we could like kind of put our foot down there. It was affordable for the building. Mm-hmm. You know, it was something that like in the end, like if no one cared about cocktails in New Orleans, like at least there was an out, you know?
Sure. You guys were an anchor in that neighborhood.
Basically. Yeah. I mean, we were early there for sure. You know, there's definitely some other places that have been there too. Mm-hmm. Blooming Deals is closing, which is a shame, you know, the old thrift store there.
Yeah.
I mean, we definitely took a risk there. Matt, I think, was the visionary genius behind that, honestly. And like me and Neil always try to make sure he gets credit for that, because it was him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, and in the early days, we kept the door locked and buzzed people in and weren't really sure. I mean, if you ever been to Cure, the entryway where the bottles are that you walk through, that was not intended as the entryway. The original entryway was the large fire
on the side street, right?
But we felt like we couldn't police it. We didn't have a door person. We just didn't know, and our biggest fear was like to get robbed or something, like opening there, because everyone was telling us like it was a dangerous area and like you're crazy and you're throwing your money away and all that stuff. So like we were definitely afraid of getting robbed or a guest getting robbed leaving or something.
Sure.
You know. But thank goodness that never happened and everything's been going well, you know?
Well, and speaking of going well, and I don't want to fast forward too far through the story because you guys really did pioneer that here. And we talked about some of the big boys that you worked at in Chicago, places you saw in New York. You guys just got the James Beard Award for Outstanding Bar Program
That's
in
correct.
The country.
Yeah.
Congratulations, man. That's
Thank
fantastic.
You. It's well deserved. Honestly, like, It's literally a dream come true. I was shocked. It's, you know, I cooked a little when I was younger, and like that was like a thing. Like a beard award was like what you could do.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And when I got into the bar business, I was like, well, there goes that idea. You know, like there was no category
right,
for it.
Right, right.
That's only about how the 5 years, six
I think
years,
it's
that
six
category's
years.
Been
yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. But yeah, it's a crazy honor. I mean, obviously my resume is great because Violet Hour won it as well. Which I, you know, it's an amazing situation to kind of be having worked at two places that have done that,
yeah.
that well, you know, it's amazing. I mean, it's a dream come true.
And how that award works too, is that, you know, it's basically determined by your peers.
Correct.
And so that's why it's a great, to me, an even more special honor,
yeah.
For lack of better grammar, because it is voted on by your peers, and it's that 100%. Kind of recognition.
That's exactly it. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, awards don't pay your bills or, you
sure.
know, they don't really, there's nothing
they don't
there.
Hurt.
I mean, they don't hurt, you know, but you know what I'm saying,
right?
Like,
exactly.
The idea, like, there's a lot of awards around. That's the one that, like, I always dreamed of winning, and, like, to, like, wear that medal and, like, talk on that stage in front of that group of people is, I mean, it's incredible to me. I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic. And I mean, you guys have worked really hard in that spot, in my view, at Cure to, well, let me ask you this question, Kirk. I'll put
sure.
it this way. You know, I think we know here in New Orleans that, you know, we can kind of argue this, maybe we'll mince this in another shot a little bit. You know, this has always been a cocktail town.
Yeah.
And, you know, things struggled here like it did anywhere else when, you know, vodka was paying the bills, as they say, and so
yeah.
on and so forth. But, you know, one might argue this is the original craft cocktail town in the country, at the least. And
I think,
you can make
yeah,
that case.
In some ways, I think the more interesting aspect of New Orleans is that whereas maybe the cocktail was invented in the Northeast or brought over from Europe,
sure,
and like
right.
New York has always had some sort of scene there, or, you know, I think in New Orleans, the special thing is that these drinks didn't go away because
exactly.
of like the preservationist mindset of the
yep.
New Orleanian in general.
Yep.
And like the idea, like in 1975, you could get a Sazerac, in 1986, you could get a Sazerac, in 1994, you could get a Sazerac, and now you can get a Sazerac. And maybe they weren't good or well produced, etc., but it was always there.
Right.
And like if you were a bartender in the city or at a noble place in New Orleans, like, you knew what that was. You knew that was a drink.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes New Orleans really special, is that history has been floating around. It's not like we just dug it up and we're like, hey, look at this old stuff we found.
And this, you know? And Kirk, that was really what my question was, because here, I think, and I always want to tell listeners that are listening in the podcast world that aren't from here, it is somewhat of a unique landscape in the way you just very well described it, that, you know, when we talk about the so-called renaissance of craft cocktails in 99, 2000-ish,
yeah.
however we want to peg that, in a lot of places, it had gone away, or if it ever existed there at all.
Exactly.
And this is a unique setting for you. So for you guys to open up Cure and operate Cure, it's not kind. It was a different landscape for you guys.
For sure. You know, I think the beauty, like I said, is that you kind of have the like historicity of it. It's there, like, and it's what's kind of kept Cure in a. We have a pretty like clear vision of what we're doing there. We're not like looking to like push the new trend. We're looking to like, you know, make the classic cocktail good. And like, we do our own iterations of those drinks. But we've never, you know, we've never like bottled fizzy cocktails or canned things or,
right.
you know, there's never right. been a tiki moment at Cure. There's never been a, you know, we've been very steady there, and it's something that we feel really strongly about. Like, those drinks are good. And they've been around a long time, and we're in New Orleans where that stuff really matters.
That matters.
And
right.
Why try to like chase like Instagram hits on it? Just like do the right thing as far as the drinks go, and always do that. And like, that's what we do. You know, there's never going to be a moment at Cure where it's like, we're doing some bizarro
spinning in some direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
It's
there.
A great way to put it, Kirk, because you guys are understanding and working then from a rich palate that's
yeah,
already there
exactly.
for you.
Yeah. We have our feet planted in the history here, and we're just trying to keep that notion alive. You know, like I said, when we were talking off air, like, I mean, the vision for Cure is for it to be there after we're dead. You know, like, I want that place to be like Arnaud's or Galatoire's 100 years from now.
Right.
You know, I think it's important that there's things like that that stay here in New Orleans that, like, don't go away. It's what makes our city special.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kirk, let's do this, man. Let's take a little break here on the show. Yeah, we'll come back, and we're going to move to the other location in which we are sitting, Cannon Table, a fine new-ish spot. Been here for a few years now. But, hey, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Jinks Show. Friends, come on back.
Whoa, sherry, wine, 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 blackberry. Wine, 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 red cherry. Wine, 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 oh, boy. Wine, wine, wine. Well, my grandma was too old ago. She listening on the radio. Her feet got happy and she grabbed a dress. The first thing she hollered, that wine is a mess. Drink wine, Cody Ole. Drinking wine, Cody Ole. Drinking wine, Cody Ole. Pass that bottle to me. Look out there. It's that wine, wine. Blackberry. Potent sherry. Half and half.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are sitting here at Cane and Table, a very fine establishment here at the 1100 block, I believe, of Decatur. And we're chatting with Kirk Stopenall, who is one of the co-owners. So we talked about Cure and your beard award-winning ways there, Kirk. And now we're here at your spot in Cane and Table. 4 years, 5 years, 6 years?
5 years.
5 years,
so
okay.
Technically, we will have been here 6 years in October.
Okay.
But Cane and Table, because we ran it as a pop-up called Perestroika,
Perestroika
for like 9 months.
Yep.
We opened in July on the 16th. So our anniversary of 5 years like starts right during Tales.
Okay, yeah.
Because we opened for Tales.
Yeah, and I remember that very well because I was here during that time.
Yeah.
So we kind of contrasting that with Cure, we talk about sort of a classic cocktail program,
yeah.
And that was really the emphasis or thrust of that here. When you guys opened up here, you had a drink focus, but there was also a food focus and some other things going on from day one here.
I mean, I think first off, like, that may not have been like by design on our choice,
okay.
but this was a restaurant. Like, the licensing is a restaurant, and we purchased a bar, which was technically a restaurant, I guess, called Pravda here. A friend of Matt, our business partner, owned a good portion of Pravda. And
oh, I didn't know
he
that.
Was okay. He wanted out. He has kids. He's just like, I thought it would be fun to open a bar, and it sucks. And so so we kind of worked out a deal, and we purchased it from them. And like, it was a restaurant, so we needed food. So we had just done the cocktails for Adam Biederman's company burger. And in trade, Adam was our consulting chef to open Cane and Table.
I didn't know that either. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So he helped us run the pop-up, and it was like Polish and Jewish food centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had worked on this development for like a kind of tiki style spot.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, Nick, our partner, really wanted to open like a full blown tiki bar here. And we were definitely entertaining that idea a great deal. But at the same time, we knew that Jeff was opening his bar shortly after.
So we're talking about Jeff Berry last year, 29,
Berry,
so people know.
Sorry,
yeah, no worries.
And also Tiki Tolteca was opening, which is like upstairs from Felipe's down the street. And me and Neil felt especially that it would be weird to open like a full-blown tiki kind of establishment when there were two others in New Orleans. If you've never been to New Orleans, there's only 300,000 people here.
Right.
Yes, 11 million visited last year, but it'd be really hard to survive like being the third of anything in this world.
It's like barbecue restaurants in mid-city. How many do you need?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like coffee shops in Algiers. Point. It's very similar. So we basically kind of backtracked a bit on that idea and said, like, let's kind of focus more on rum as a spirit. And then where does that kind of go from there? And we all did a bunch of research. Nick dug really deeply into like some like really early American drinks. And kind of developed an idea there that was like, we touch on tiki, but we lean back into very, very classic drinks. What we say is like
punches, things, for example, right?
Exactly. Punches, slings, Santa Grays, toddies, all that kind of stuff. So there's a very rich history of rum drinks in America, obviously, because there was like hundreds of rum distilleries in up the East Coast and in the South around that and around the like, turn of the beginning of the country, I guess, you know, when New Orleans is being built, essentially. So there's a lot there. And it kind of leaned into more simplistic drinks, which we prefer. Obviously, if you've ever been to Cure, that's what we like. Kind of a very basic drink that tastes good first and like is contemplative later, I would say. So we kind of put that down as our model and then designed a menu. And we kind of gave ourselves some restraint there. And the idea was like, if it's produced, if it's food from a rum producing country, then we can touch it. If it's not, then we can't. And that gives you a lot of breath.
Sure. Absolutely.
But over the years, we've really kind of leaned it a lot more into like Central and South America and Cuba. Our chef is Cuban. It's my friend Alfredo Noguera. He's been here his whole life, grew up here. We actually moved to Chicago together. He stayed a bunch of years after I did. I convinced him to move home a couple years ago. So it's very focused in that sort of world, which has been nice. It's given us a very nice, like, clear vision of, like, what we are. And I think that's very important for a restaurant.
I think when you guys brought Alfredo on, in my humble opinion, that's when the kitchen really found a focus, right?
I think agree. What you're saying. I mean, that's 100% what we're looking for. I always felt like, you know, we've always been known as cocktail people. And like to the food had, we needed a person that was really could drive that creative, that was like passionate as we are about drinks, as they are about food. And Alfredo, I mean, after Adam, who couldn't really give us much time, he did a great job. I'm not saying he didn't, but like Alfredo really like brought that, you know, he settled the sand into something that we really feel very strongly about, you know?
And so you got, and because I'll hear people chalk up can and table, and I think it's, you know, we all want a convenient way to explain things. So I appreciate what you just said, because people kind of refer to it as proto tiki, which is kind of
a non-term.
Like it's sort of a proto of a faux culture is what I'm trying to say.
100%. I mean, we won't deny that that was designed for PR.
Okay, good move. I like it.
You know, they say you need something digestible. We felt like that kind of explained what we did. Ironically, I just read an article with Dave Arnold, who's opening a new bar in New York, and he actually mentioned that term, which I thought was really funny.
Oh, that's
like,
cool.
Yeah, because like I like kind of crawl about that term a little bit.
It's funny, Kirk, because when we're sitting somewhere else and we're, you know, obviously as we do here in New Orleans, we're sitting next to somebody who's visiting. We like to share our hospitality here, and we'll tell people where to go, and we will always tell people this is a great place you need to go check out. And I'll say, you know, and people ask, well, what kind of bars in? I'll say, what sort of proto tiki? And in the back of my mind, I'm going, what the hell am I actually saying?
I just say it's rum drinks, and rum, we do like really classic leaning. You know, we make drinks from like the early presidents to about the Mai Tai. It's kind of like our history boundary.
Right. Yeah. Now, one of the things that you guys have done here too at Cane and Table, which I think is really cool, as well as Cure, is a lot of folks have come up through the bartending ranks here in New Orleans, and it builds, you guys have built people's careers, and I think that's a really cool thing.
It's what you have to do in this business. I mean, it's important. My philosophy, and I get this directly from Terry in Chicago, who's my mentor from One Off Hospitality, is that everyone that leaves you should be going on to something better. If people are leaving you making sideways moves, your culture is bad. You need to figure that out.
Right.
So to me, it's like, When I find out a staff member is leaving, it's never a nervous feeling or a sad feeling. It's because I know almost everyone that leaves us is going on to like grow their career.
Yeah.
And that's important. I mean, if no one did that for me, I would not be here. If no one did that for Neil, we wouldn't be here. And we need to be that next person in line. I mean, it's a part of being in the culinary world is a passing on of knowledge. You know?
Sure.
Some people want to control that, and it's a hard thing to control. And like the reality is, you know, without people like Jeff Barry, we might not know a lot about Don the Beachcomber's drinks because he kept that stuff secret.
Right.
And that's dangerous for culture. You know.
I couldn't agree more.
If someone like hid away the gumbo recipe, like it wouldn't be a thing that's everywhere. You know.
Exactly.
And like my feeling is that, like, I mean, I always make this like lasagna thing. Like, you know, everybody's mom makes some lasagna. It might not be the same lasagna.
We can all argue about who's red gravy is who's red gravy.
But it's all lasagna. It's all lasagna. And I think that's it. You know, you teach everyone how to do what you do, they're going to extrapolate that. No one's going to just carbon copy you. So there's no reason to really protect that, in my opinion.
Good words.
Kurt. Unless you're, I don't know. I don't know who would want to do that, right?
You want to do your own thing.
The reason why people are ambitious is to show that they can do things better. And like, that's what we want. I want people that take what I do and push it further, the better, you know, figure out little details that make it better, you know.
Synthesize what they do and
exactly.
Move forward. Well, Kirk, before we sign off the radio portion here of the show, let's tell people how do we find Cane and Table and Cure both on the street and online?
Yeah, so both of our Instagram handles are really simple. It's Cane and Table and Cure Nola. On Instagram, our Instagram's great. You should check it out. Where our street addresses are, for Cure, it's 4905 Ferret Street, and that's uptown in New Orleans. And then Cane and Table is in the French Quarter at 1113 Decatur Street.
Excellent. Yeah. Kirk, thanks very much. And so what we're going to do, I want to encourage listeners, if you're on the radio, go get the podcast. Kirk and I are going to stick around and talk a little bit more. And if you're listening to the podcast, it's just going to happen to you anyway. So we're going to take a little break here on the show, friends. And we're going to come back with another shot with Nola Drinks. If you're listening here on the radio, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Everybody, appreciate you hanging around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Oh yeah, you bet. That's the theme song to another shot with Nola Drinks, Saints and Sinners, by our good friends, the fantastic New Orleans bass band, Bon Vivant. Go check them out. They are at bbvband.com. Hope you're enjoying our conversation here with Kirk Estopinal of Cure and Cane and Table. That's what we're going to do here on another shot. We're going to keep chatting with Kirk, and then we'll be back with our parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, welcome to another shot with Nola Drinks. Thanks for hanging out with us a little bit further here today on the show. Very pleased to be here sitting at Cane and Table with Kirk Estopinal. And Kirk, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today, man. So
absolutely.
Kind of the first time we've actually had any sort of other, you know, I mean, I've known you for a few
meaningful
years, but like any
conversation.
Meaningful conversation.
Yeah, yeah,
here
yeah.
with microphones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least like not over a bar or something.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And, it's going to be cursory, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Very good, man. And I appreciate your hospitality here today, and it's been fun chatting with you. One of the things that we left off with in the radio portion, Kirk, is understanding the tradition. And I really like what you were saying with a lot of these thoughts about tutoring people, mentoring people, and then even the three, even let's make this even broader, the idea of being so guarded over things in a tradition. We're talking about anything like this. Culinary is an art. Cocktails are an art, very much like anything. Can't live in a vacuum. It doesn't survive
exactly,
if it lives
exactly,
in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you guys take very seriously the idea of, you know, go forth, grasshopper, and do what you're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, it really is just like, you know, it's our philosophy. I mean, we understand that people can give us so much time before it behooves them to move on, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in working with people that are looking to like do dynamic things in this industry. And, I try to hire people that have these kinds of ambitions. It's a big part of my discussion when I do interviews, even to just discuss, like, what do you want to do? Like, what are your dreams? What do you need to know?
So the right answer is not necessarily, I see myself here in 15 years.
It's actually the wrong answer. Yeah. I mean, look, I would love anyone that wants to stay, but
I'm not buying it.
Yeah. I mean, we have those people. Turk at Cure has been with us for 10 years. Mm-hmm. We grew up together. We've been friends forever.
Okay.
I've known Turk way longer than I've known Neil.
Okay. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Ryan Gannon, very similar. Yeah. You know, he's been with us a long time, you know, very happy where he is. But I think both of them will go on to open bars with us in the future. And I would really enjoy doing that.
And that's another avenue, right? That's possible.
Exactly. It's something that I realized from Donald Link. Kind of like being at Herb Saint and like opening Koshan with Strajewski and then taking Ryan Pruitt and opening Pesh. Mm-hmm. And like, it makes sense. Like, you could either have like these people as your competition or you can have them as your ally, like, and do great things with them, you know? And like, if we have that opportunity with a person that works for us that, like, you know, really drives it all the way to that project, like where they have a very clear vision, like we're more than happy to take the dive, you know?
Go ahead, Kurt.
It's a big part of, you know, what we do. You know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. How do you guys, and we'll just even maybe sticking to the bar side of things as opposed to the food side of things, but I think it's kind of universal here. How do you find that balance of somebody comes in, they're new, mm-hmm. they need to be trained. There's a way that you guys go about doing things. Yeah. How do you find that balance between training and learning and then empowering?
I think it's an approach. A big part of the way me and Neil have lightly different philosophy there as far as like how we see that happening. My thing has always been like give people the information they need and try to present it in a way that is not deadly serious. So that number one, it helps them explain to guests in a way that is not, you know, aloof or
it's not the gospel or
too much information, like overload people, like some, you know, the one thing me and you always say is like, people ask you what time it is. They don't ask you how to build a watch, right? So like we that's our big thing. Like tell people what time it is. You don't have to tell them like the gear ratio inside of there. Right. They don't care. They want to know.
And you can read those people, right? Just because you will get the people that want the gear ratio and you know who they are and then you can go down
that
road.
They're very easy to find. Right. Correct. Yeah. So like that's the deal. Like it's kind of like what I'm looking to do is instill passion into people that are looking for something there, right? If you're deeply interested in this, and I will give you everything you want to know. If you are not, then I will give you what you need to know. Mm-hmm. And there are people that's all they want. And they can be amazing bartenders, amazing managers, whatever, right? And then there are people that want to dig deep. And those are the people that I'll go in that deep dive with, you know?
Yeah.
And in the end, what I want is people that are here to do their job and not, they don't need me, you know? Like, if you need me there to be like, do this, do that, then I don't want you here, mm-hmm. you know? I've always been like that as an employee for people. Like, I get it. You got a lot going on, and you hired me to do this thing, and I'm going to do this thing the best of my abilities. And then at the same time, like, I will get out of their way. If they get out of my way, right? And if they want to do something that maybe seems lofty or crazy, I always take the chance.
Okay.
You know, we do a pop-up for Natural Wine upstairs every week on Wednesday here.
Here at Candy Table,
it's called Suspected. And Gabe, who does our wine purchasing, he's a server here. Works with Uznia, who used to purchase for Bacchanal for a bunch of years.
Yep.
That's their show. Like, they buy wine from me and they make the money. Like, it's like it does not behoove Cane and Table in any way beyond the fact that I feel like I'm helping develop Gabe.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of stuff that's like important to do. You know, if somebody wants to do a pop-up, then I say yes. You know?
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you know, what do you want to do? You want to do a black metal bar night? Sure. Let's do it.
Okay.
You know,
let's give it a shot.
And those, you let people try those ideas out. That's a lucky circumstance to be in. Like, 'cause you might think your idea is great, and then you try it and no one cares.
Mm-hmm.
And at least you didn't open a bar
doing that. You know what I mean? Like, right, that's a lot of money on the line there.
That's,
you know,
a softer fall.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the kind of stuff, like, you know, you got to give people, like, you know, people say enough rope to hang themselves with or whatever, but I think that's important. And I always just try to be very positive with my staff and say, if you're passionate about this, let's chase this, you know?
Sure.
And I just want to surround myself by people that are like that, you know, and I want them to feel the same, you know, and that's kind of how we build our staff. It always has been, you know, some people don't make it and some people do.
Yeah.
This is part of the deal.
Yeah. Know? That makes a lot of sense, is that you're creating an environment where it's like, it's a sink or swim thing, right? I mean, I hate to use another hackneyed or cliche expression, but
I mean, at the end of the day, like, you can't monitor what your staff does behind a bar. Right.
Sure.
Like, not in a controlling way. Right. You just have to, like, we hire people based on personality. Like, I can teach you how to make drinks. I cannot teach you how to be nice.
Right.
Like, some people just aren't nice.
Yeah.
And, like, those people I don't want, you know?
Exactly.
My interview process is an hour-long conversation. And if you can talk to me for an hour and it's engaging, then you're hired. And if you can't, then I don't want to hire you. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That makes sense. And I really like that, Kirk, because I think we know, you know, I will always say, you know, I hate to use this expression. I'm just going all cliche at this point.
Let's go for it.
Let's go. You know, a widget's a widget, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so I can teach you this skill.
Exactly.
What I can't teach you is exactly as you said. So presenting room, hospitality.
Exactly.
And I mean, you can teach some of that stuff, but it's got to be innate to somebody's nature, right?
Exactly. I think, like, if you're hiring very young people, that's possible.
Okay.
When you're hiring someone that's, like, been in the industry for 10 years and they don't have that, they don't have that. You know?
Yeah, and they're just not, and they're never going to get it. Right?
Yeah. I mean, my friend Charlie, who got me that job in Chicago that we talked about before, he always would say, like, there are people that, like, choose to be in this industry, and there are people that end up in this industry. Be the one that chooses to be, or get the hell out.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And, like, those are the people that me and Neil look for in this business. Like, it's a profession. You can be deadly serious about it. Yes, you can still have fun, but it is still your job, you know? And, like, it's like that whole thing, like, if you or have an office job and you show up on Monday and you're like, I am so hungover, I'm going to die, and tell your boss that, like, your boss is going to be like, get out of here. Right. But in the drinks business, it seems like that's okay. And I think those are the bad signs that I look for in a person. Like, if someone's like talking about how wasted they were the night before at my interview, then it's a precarious situation.
Right.
You know?
You're not treating it professionally. And it is a unique, a unique
environment.
Everybody
parties,
right.
Sure. Know, it's not a badge of honor to have a hangover, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree more. So Kirk, you mentioned something when we were off air between one of the segments that we did, sort of a similar outlook on how you deal with brands. And I kind of wanted to pick your brain on, what do you mean by that? Well, you kind of mentioned, like, something about, you know, we were talking about, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think, you know, well, there's any number of rums out there. There's any number of this out there.
Yeah.
And we're sort of talking about mentorship and more of an open book approach. And you alluded to something in how you deal with brands. And
I mean, to me, there's a lot of stuff I could buy as far as brands go. And, like, something I learned early in the business is that it's, like, a lot about relationships. So we kind of look for that avenue with brands. Like, is it someone that we kind of see eye to eye with, or is truthful, or, you know, whatever. And that kind of helps us guide what we purchase a lot, or what we really lean on. I mean, there's things we buy that are just things you got to have 'cause you're a bar. But as far as that goes, it's, to me, I'm looking to work with people that are trying to do something akin to what I'm trying to do. If that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you guys go about doing that kind of stuff too, obviously there's a lot of tasting and understanding that goes on.
Well, without a doubt. Yeah. We do blind tastings of products against products that we have that are similar. If they don't pass that test, then they don't make it on the back bar. I mean, that's always been our way. We've actually found, like, we hate a product we thought we loved 3 years later. You taste it against something that is new and you're like, wait, this one's bad. What is this bad one?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, that is the thing. It's the thing I've been saying I love, you know. I mean, alcohol products are agricultural products. They change.
Yes.
Over time, they do. I mean, it's not It's not, I don't think it's like, a lot of people like to paint that as like weird, like corporate cost-cutting measures or whatever, but some of it is just like happenstance, you know? A guy leaves, another guy comes along that blends, or, you know, and these things change. You do have to kind of keep your ear and your feet in there a bit to kind of make sure you're like reassessing what you think you love all the time, because you never know, like, things change.
And, that's a great point, especially, I think, you know, it works across the board, no matter if we're talking about small, medium, or large brands, but especially small brands, right? Yeah. I mean, where...
Even large. The most shocking ones have been large, honestly.
Where there has been a significant change in the flavor profile.
Yeah, and, I mean, there are some brands that are like stone, and they never change. I mean, I'm not going to mention them, but you can probably guess, like, some of the big brands. Like, there's a big rum brand that has been very, very steady for a long time. And I think, you know, some of that, if you're moving millions of gallons of something, then standardization is very, very important, you know? But yeah, just
Budweiser's like, Budweiser for a reason.
Right, exactly. But like rums and things like that, I find rums and tequilas mostly have like a big change. Mm-hmm. But I think that has a lot to do with like the source materials, you know?
Absolutely.
And like sometimes it's not the same, you know? It just is what it is. Like a more higher acid profile or a thicker profile in the body, and it changes a lot, and that could make you gravitate toward or gravitate away from it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And we talk about this sometimes on the show. We talk about, I think, you know, certain sets of spirits are, I think all of them do, but I think certain sets of spirits, it's a little more acute, like Pisco or Mezcal both spring to mind, where you actually taste terroir in those.
I think that's what makes them special.
That is what makes them special. And the cultural connection, in my mind, is also really, which is also part of terroir.
And the cultural connection is real. It's not a story.
Exactly.
You know, the booze brands are, there's a lot of story out there. Not all of it's true.
Who was it? I want to say, wasn't maybe the Remy Martin guy a couple years ago? It was a cognac producer. You know, was complaining at some symposium in Europe about 2 years ago, and he was bitching about dusty origin stories.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that BS out there.
Absolutely, yeah. Wayne Curtis wrote a great article about it years ago in The Atlantic that was like really shined the light on a couple of spots. That you know, you hear these stories and like it's cool, but is it real?
Yeah.
You know?
Walking against the crowd up a street that's supposed to be in Cuba, even though your company's not in Cuba. Am I guessing what rum company we're talking about before? Maybe. Anyway, we can. We can move on from that.
Good juice, though. Good juice. Yeah, no there jokes. You go. I do like their product a lot.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Kirk, another thing. Let's touch on this before we close things out here. We were talking a little bit, we touched on this about work-life balance. And now you're talking about, you know, don't show up to work hungover, this is your job.
Yeah.
This is a difficult industry in which to strike work-life balance.
It is, yeah.
And I know it's something you and I were talking about off-air, that you're, as you've gotten older, you have a family, so your viewpoints of this have changed, as well as your lifestyle has changed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a big thing for me in the last few years has been just, like, do I drink? And when do I drink? And how does that affect... You know, going back to the mentoring thing, I think it's the major thing that I realize is that as an older, like, owner in this business that's, I mean, I guess I'm accomplished, you know, people, you know, see me as a person that could mentor them.
I think that's fair.
I realize that, like, me getting intoxicated at work or even just after work was a bad scene. It taught people things that I don't want to teach people. Mm-hmm. I came up in an industry of that, like drinking was like part of what you did as a bartender. And it's dangerous. I don't think it's a healthy lifestyle, especially for something that is, you know, you can win a James Beard doing this. Like this is a recognized thing, you know, just like slinging drinks anymore. And I think that's a big thing. I mean, look, there's a lot of guys out there in the chef world that have like recovered and like have changed that kind of mindset. And I think there needs to be more people in our industry talking about that. Like, you know, working dry, you know, there's no need to drink at work. And it really has helped me a lot, to be, I don't know. I feel like I'm better at what I do, on like an inspirational level, on a, like a pragmatic, work-life balance level. Mm-hmm. That's really important for me to kind of show, the younger generation coming up that like, you don't have to drink to like get ahead in this business.
Right.
You know, you can still work deals out with liquor reps that want to drink and don't drink. You know, like it's not part of the deal. My grandfather was a customer consultant for a large shipyard here in New Orleans called Avondale. And his deal was like, his job was like to close the deal, right? And I mean, he closed the deal with like the Navy and like all sorts of giant ship companies. Actually, they made a container for Bacardi even. And he didn't drink at all. And like kind of like did the fake drink thing back in the day. And like, I never really put it together till I was older. I thought it was just weird that my grandpa didn't drink. But I think it was like a wherewithal thing that like helped him actually become more successful, because he's in a world of like, you know, this is like Mad Men era.
Yeah.
Know,
okay.
You get off work, you go out to your business meetings and you get smashed with the guys, you know? And I think that like he was wise enough to see that. And now that he's passed on and I'm older, I kind of see that vision, like you being successful in this business. There's no drop of alcohol has to pass your lips, really, you know? Well, at least pass your throat, you know? You have to taste.
But right.
You can spit. It's not weird to do.
Sure.
And I think I always talk about that with the staff. It's like, you can spit. It's good to spit. It's not bad. Like, go to a wine tasting, there's 100 wines. You can't possibly taste them all. Pick the ones you really want to taste and spit.
Yeah.
You know? And that way you remember what you did and all that stuff.
Sure.
You know?
And tasting pours, you know, there's a difference. One of the things I always used to say working in the wine industry a long time ago, there's a difference between drinking and tasting.
Yeah.
So even if you don't necessarily spit, we're talking about, you know, in the case of spirits, maybe a half ounce pour, an ounce pour, case of wine, 2 ounce pour, sampling 6 wines. Okay. Maybe you've had a glass of wine, but if that's all you've done that afternoon,
then you're fine.
Then you're fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And everybody's different, right? I mean, everybody and how 100%. They manage that is different and how they can handle this or not handle this and understanding it that way.
That's a big part of why I've decided to not drink at work ever, and because I don't know who can and who can't, and I don't want to create ruin someone's availability to this career by teaching them that drinking's okay, because some people can't do it,
right? You know? And maintain that level of professionalism that we're talking
100%.
About. Well, do me a favor, Kirk, before we close things out. I know we did this at the end of the radio show, but tell people again where Cane and Table, Cure, where we can find y'all.
Yeah, sure. So Cure is at 4905 Ferrette Street, uptown in New Orleans. And Cane and Table is in the French Quarter here, 1113 Decatur Street. And the Instagram handles are Cane and Table and Cure Nola. We have websites, but who looks at restaurant websites?
Yeah, fair enough. I'm old. I still kind of do, but okay. Yeah, right on. Well, Kirk, thanks so much, man, for hospitality today and taking some time. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks,
Kirk. I appreciate it. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed our conversation there with Kirk Estopinal of Cure and Cane and Table. Very interesting guy, very nice guy. First time that we've had Kirk on the show. I've known him for a little while, but great to chat with him, and I'm sure that we will have him back. Of course, one of the things that we touched on, friends, on the show with Kirk is talking about that work-life balance, and in particular, talking about drinking on the job and not drinking on the job. As you know, if you just listen, Kirk no longer drinks on the job, and he no longer expects his employees to do so. And this is where we're going to go with our parting shot here on the show. Friends, I think we know when you work, and we're going to kind of focus on the bartender angle, but I think a lot of this applies to the hospitality and spirits industry in general. It's really kind of a lifestyle, right? In most instances, and with many people, most people that work in it, it's a choice of a lifestyle. By definition, then, therefore, you are around alcohol. It is the engine that drives the bus in many of these cases. It's served in the establishments. This is very much what we're talking about. These are the products that people make if you're in the spirits industry side. We know the part about, we've talked about this, about camaraderie. You're working odd hours. You're going out after work with your tip money, with your friends. There's a term that we even have in the industry, industry bars, those places that we refer to, where people go after they get off work or where industry people hang out. This is often, for example, in New Orleans, where we don't shut down the drinking at any particular hour. 3 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock in the morning, this is what you do. Late nights, odd hours, these sorts of things. There's also the part when you're on the job that you're, when you're behind the stick and tending bar, you're building a night, you're hosting a room, you're presenting hospitality. And that can often be perceived, at least, as having alcohol as an integral part for yourself as the bartender, not just for your patrons and things like that. So what I'm saying is this is very much ingrained in the whole process, but some things that maybe those of us who are customers don't necessarily see. You're always doing tastings. You have reps coming in that are trying to sell you products. You're workshopping drinks for your happy hour menu. There are the perks that come from the distributors and the manufacturers that make these products. They make alcohol. They sell alcohol. Lots of times these perks are gifts of bottles or events they invite you to that involve alcohol. Maybe another thing that we don't necessarily see if we're not in the industry is the stressful lifestyle. Again, you're working odd hours and there's already that stuff that we've talked about, but man, you can sometimes be running and gunning and banging out drinks for several hours and be three deep at the bar, and alcohol can be used, if you will, for better or for worse, as a way to get through your shift. Yeah, you're pouring shots and maybe doing shots with your customers, you're doing shift shots with your colleagues, shift shots, that's what I'm trying to say, and so on and so forth. And I'm not putting a value judgment on, I'm just saying it is all around you and it is very prevalent in the lifestyle. I want to throw some numbers at you, and this goes back to 2011. Didn't really find much newer on this, but I'm guessing these numbers largely hold. Business Insider magazine reported that bartenders were the most likely professional group in the U.S. to die from alcohol abuse. And what they did is they compiled death certificates related to on-job demises, on-job fatalities, and they took this from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, trying to say that, which is the NIOSH, and what they did is they looked at 8,361 death certificates of white males only. 294 of those deaths were alcohol-related. They also noted that among white American women, bartenders were also the most likely professional group to die from alcohol abuse. There you go. Also reported in 2014 in the UK, this was in the spirits business initially, a particular charity over there called the Licensed Trade Charity Support and Care Arm. What they do is they seek to support trade members through emotional and financial support. And they, quote, recognize the issue of hazardous drinking across the industry, which is a real concern. They go on to note that bar staff suffer from cirrhosis and other alcohol-related health problems more than people in any other job. In addition, another UK charity called Hospitality Action also acknowledged the prevalence of alcohol dependency in the industry. They noted those working in the industry have 15% of the industry suffers with alcohol or drug dependency compared to a 9% average in the UK among folks in other jobs. Let's throw in the fact that for many of the people that work in the hospitality industry and service industry, in particular in the United States, do not have health insurance. They do not have access to health insurance. It's not included by their employer. So the cost of seeking out preventative things or treatment things such as substance abuse therapy can be very costly and essentially out of their reach, let alone the idea of long-term health issues that can come from chemical and substance abuse dependency, serious issues. Treatment that is required can also be cost prohibitive and out of people's reach. Now, there are choices, friends, that can be made and are being made in the industry. One is talking about this and addressing this. I think the industry is doing a better job with it. One of the things that I'm starting to see more and more of is brands, those that are making the alcoholic products, are starting to shift resources through their brand ambassadors and brand representatives. And these are folks that are out, boots on the ground, if you will, selling the brand on behalf of the producer. So what often brand ambassadors and brand reps do, and you know this if you listen to the show, they go out to bars, they host events, they do things, they buy shots for the bartenders, maybe they buy some drinks for the guests sitting at the bar as a way to promote the brand. But I'm seeing more of my friends in the industry that are ambassadors and reps have more resources being thrown their way, meaning more of a budget to do things that are not alcohol-centric. Yoga, exercise stuff, events that are not alcohol-centric. I think that's a very good way to go about this. It's still a great way to share your brand. It's a great way to provide some alternatives and some resources for people to do things that maybe they can't afford. For example, you know, taking yoga ain't cheap either. And offering it in hours that are friendly to people that work in the service industry might be another barrier. Now, when it comes to other choices, I'm going to break these down into three groups. We're going to talk about companies, which I mean venues, industry folks, meaning the folks working in the industry, and then consumers or customers. When it comes to companies, I think the big question is to drink or not to drink. I'm not putting a value judgment on that. If you were to ask me, if I ran a bar, if I was a small independent guy, I would allow drinking on the job. As I said at the top of the show, it becomes a question of maintaining a level of professionalism and maintaining the presentation of your space. How much alcohol an individual can handle is up to them, with the caveat being that they maintain their professionalism throughout this. That question of professionalism also relates to being conducive to the idea that not only are you professional during your shift, but you are also maintaining a lifestyle, that allows you to be professional on an ongoing basis, meaning being able to show up for your next shift. So there's a culture that has to happen kind of here, and that'll get to the individual stuff in a second. But as far as it relates to companies, I'm not going to put a value judgment on that. I think that moderation needs to be supported. If an employee chooses not to drink during a shift or not to drink on the job during service shifts, also needs to be maintained and fostered. I think employers, must make sure that employees can succeed without having to drink while they're on the clock. Now, let's take a step this way into the individuals and industry folks. One of the things that we know, part of working in the industry, selling spirits or making cocktails, evaluation and your palate are very important. You've got to taste stuff when people come in and sell products to you. As you're workshopping a drink for the happy hour menu, working with your colleagues to develop a cocktail, you've got to taste. Okay, there are some options there. You can always spit, for example. A lot of folks, different bartenders that have given up drinking socially and given up drinking shift shots and so on and so forth, still sip a little bit when they're workshopping drinks and doing some of these things because they can maintain that restraint, if you will, and they feel that that is an important and critical part of their job. Now, there are others that are alcoholics that we know that you can't even have a drop. So you need to be able to make that work as well. If you're working in the industry and being able to move forward, trusting your colleagues to help you, for example, in evaluation. These are choices that you have to make as an individual and how you handle this. And these are choices that companies also need to make to support their employees. But moving further, that kind of overlapped a little bit, but moving further, into individuals, you have to find that balance. You can't just sort of, you know, go out, work the hard shift, do shots, go hit the industry bar, go home, go to sleep. And as I said, lather, rinse, and repeat, as I often say. Anyway, you need to go out and do other things. You need to exercise. You need to pursue a hobby. If you're maybe going to do shift shots because you think it's an important part of your presentation, that's great. More power to you. Options such as lower ABV shots, do shots of vermouth, do shots of Amaro, so on and so forth. When you give your guests a shot, if they want tequila, give them tequila. Do a shot of ginger. It's good for your digestion. Something like that. So if you still believe in the ceremony, you can still do that, or you can go lower ABV. Now, lastly, let me move into the customer side. Don't expect the party hardy bartender to be there to go along for the drink and ride with you every time you go into the bar. Sure, it's fun. Sure, it's nice. When it happens, it's great. But don't have that as an expectation. You can still have a laugh. You can still have a shot. And you can still have a great time. Remember that these folks that are there behind the stick serving you alcohol are there to provide hospitality. They're not necessarily there to be your drinking buddy. So make sure that that is not an expectation of yours every time you go out and somebody offers you a shot or you're looking for shots or you're drinking. It doesn't have to be a part of the landscape every time, all the time for people working in the industry. Friends, that's our parting shot here on the NOLA Drink Show. Really appreciate it. Going to be back next week with Fred Perron of Hendrix Gin. Here's to you. I'll be saying, I'll be seeing as we try.